or the trusted cloud and trust and compliance, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a very engaging conversation with the hosts and the organizers. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do a session or a talk on the relevance of trust and the relevance of compliance if you're using cloud services, for example, in regulated industries like financial services or healthcare. Yeah, I would love to do a talk on compliance and security and whatever we're doing in that domain. And then afterwards, they said, yeah, you're going to have a challenge, though, because your job title is a technology officer, and it's going to be a developer conference. So there's going to be a barrier there, probably. And then I said, OK, if there is some sentiment, animosity, perhaps, some challenges between a job title like a technology officer and developer, maybe choose a different subject than compliance, maybe something that we can have a conversation with developers on and have an interactive session and engagement on a small topic where we can have questions and discussions. So let's do something on blockchain with a small community, perhaps 5 or 10 people would show up. That turns out a little bit differently than expected, I see. So it may be that I need to do a little bit of presenting after all, where I was kind of like expecting to have an interactive discussion or a conversation on blockchain, the relevance of blockchain, what blockchain actually is, or what blockchain could mean to the economy, society, to you, to your job, to your roles, etc. So let's see where we end up with this session. It's going to last just about 45 minutes, I think, but you're welcome to stay longer and have some questions or interaction afterwards. But I wanted to highlight a little bit about blockchain, and I also wanted to highlight why I'm actually quite happy that there are so many people here attending a session on blockchain, which was introduced, by the way, a second barrier, as a level 100 session. So if you're already up to speed and very experienced in blockchain, I will redirect any questions coming to me to you, right? Okay. So this is a level 100. It's easy. It's context. It's some positioning. It's some discussion. But why is it important? Why do I think it's important that we're having this session with this audience especially? And one thing came to mind. With many conversations that I've been having with industry associations, for example, or policymakers and government, the majority of important, if you will, relevant people in policymaking have no clue whatsoever about the blockchain or about the blockchain's potential to completely redesign, if you will, processes in the industry and maybe even completely redesign industries altogether. The majority of policymakers, the majority of people in a decision-making capacity have no clue about what is going on. And this may be one of the domains where, in fact, technology-driven people, where, in fact, developers, programmers, whatever you like to refer to for yourself, hackers, if you want, but where we as an audience, where you as a people may need to make a difference. We need to land the story about the potential of blockchain with the decision and the policy-making audiences. So I'm quite happy with the turn-up. It's slightly larger than we were expecting, so it's going to be perhaps more presenting than discussing, but that's okay. So I'm a technology officer for Microsoft, 10 years at Microsoft in the Netherlands. The majority of my time, I was rethinking what I've been doing for the last 10 years. The majority of my time I've been spending in trust conversations. And it already started when I joined Microsoft, because at the time I was leading an open source initiative in Microsoft. And remember, this was 10 years ago. This was before what we now like to call the new Microsoft. So I was working on explaining why, in fact, closed source or licensed software could be trusted. Because, for example, you could verify the source code, we could be transparent about the source code. It's just different. It's not open source licensed, but it's different. But you can still trust closed source. And there are means and algorithms and procedures to do that. So even when I started 10 years ago, the conversation was basically about trust. Then I entered in a situation where, perhaps if you're Dutch, you may remember the incident called DigiNotar. And I ended up to being the liaison on behalf of Microsoft Netherlands with the Dutch Crisis Center in the city of The Hague. And that is also basically a conversation about trust. Can digital certificates, if you send out a transaction between System A and System B, that transaction needs to be signed. So in order for System B to understand that indeed this message, this transaction originated from System A, for example. So transactions were digitally signed with certificates. And what happened with DigiNotar was basically that there was a hack with the DigiNotar organization, and they issued these trusted signatures on these certificates on behalf of the Dutch government, for example. And suddenly, the signature could no longer be trusted. There you have it again. It could no longer be trusted. We were not sure if a message came from System A, if that was really an authentic message coming from System A, or it was some hacker spoofing System A, etc. So the messages itself were not trusted. And if you remember, at the Digi-Noter age, there were a lot of media articles and news articles, items, complaining that citizens in the Netherlands would no longer be able to access digital services from public sector, from the municipalities, for example. Where in reality, this was actually no longer a big concern for us. It was a problem, serious problem, of course, but the real concern was that indeed a lot of vital industries in the Netherlands were using digital signatures signed by the Digi-Noter organization. So for example, all the containers coming in the harbor here in Amsterdam, they are digitally signed. All transactions with the tax office in the Netherlands, digitally signed, etc. So we were worried that if an organization like Microsoft would revoke the Digi-Noter certificates, the PKI overheid certificates, as being not trustworthy, that basically the whole economy in the Netherlands would come to a standstill. That was the real concern. So Digi-Noter was about trust, was about certificates, and now I'm in a lot of conversations, I mentioned this briefly at the beginning, about can we trust the online services? Can we attest to, for example, a supervisor in the financial services industry or in the healthcare? Can we make sure that they understand the assurances that Microsoft provides that indeed the online services are trustworthy? So again, it's about trust. So for 10 years, basically, I've been doing nothing else but having trust conversations with policymakers, with decision makers, with developers, with customers, with partners, within Microsoft, etc. So I find that it's interesting. We apparently, in the ICT industry, we think trust, or it has become, a very relevant and a very big thing. And then the conversation came to a domain called blockchain. This is something different than Bitcoin, but you'll see that later. It's about blockchain. And what is interesting, I find about blockchain, is when there's a brilliant presentation by Dr. Gavin Wood, without the S, by the way, on YouTube. And it's blockchain for dummies, it's very interesting, or Ethereum for dummies, very interesting presentation. But what really triggered me was when he was asked in this presentation, or during this presentation, he was asked, so right, Mr. Wood, why actually did you invent, why actually did you develop Ethereum? Why actually did you start to use the blockchain? And what is your vision for the future? What do you want the blockchain to be? What do you want Ethereum to become, etc.? And the basic response that Gavin Wood gave was, well, in reality, I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's very difficult to look ahead in this industry for the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. It's very difficult, of course, I'm not sure. I just attempt to be useful, or I'm attempting to make Ethereum useful and inclusive for as many people as possible. And that's probably a good way of looking at what we're doing. I thought it was interesting. Have you seen the TED video? The TED video about starting with the why. Have you seen that? And it's explaining to a lot of organizations why it's important for an organization to have a mission statement. You need to do something useful for society and the economy. You have to start your business, you have to start your product development with a why question. And here's Gavin, Dr. Gavin, explaining basically, I'm not really sure about why. I just knew about the how, what I wanted to do, and I ended up developing something, or we ended up developing something, and now I am designing what it could actually be used for. And in fact, it's not just me designing what it could be used for, it's the customers, it's the developers around Ethereum making up new domains for adoption and implementation of Ethereum, for example. And if you're wondering by now, what the heck is Ethereum? That's what we're going to address today in this session, as an example. And I thought give a little bit of a historic perspective on this, going back about 4,000 years, so far enough. This is a ledger. So in many industries, in many processes, we need to document the process itself. Transactions in the process, for example. You buy something, you sell something, you want to write it down. Are you sure what was paid? Do I want documentation of the transaction, etc.? And this ledgering, if you will, this ledger system, this system of ledgers, has been going on for thousands of years already. And this is actually, I found, a very interesting example. Because if you're like me, and I'm by the way, I'm 48 years old. I was at a Bryan Ferry concert last night, and I'm old enough to know who Bryan Ferry is. You as well, majority of you. So I was sending out a tweet, I was sending out a Facebook message that I'm at Brian Ferry concert in the city of Groningen in the north of Netherlands. And a lot of my colleagues responded, Brian who? But Brian Ferry is the former lead singer of Roxy Music. Did that help? Okay, I'm old, I know. Not this old, not 4,000 years old, but I'm old, I know. But I was always wondering for the last, maybe not 48 years, but for many years. So you've got these stone tablets, you've got these stone ledgers. So how do they send them? How do they distribute? How do they make sure the ledger gets from location A to location B? And apparently, according to the text, they put them in an envelope. Can you imagine this? So if you've got a 4,000-year-old stone tablet, a stone ledger, what would the envelope look like? But they did. Anyway, so I think it's interesting. Thousands of years, the human society, human economy, we've been using ledgers. And an interesting element to this form of ledgering, if you will, in stone tablets, is it's quite difficult to erase something, right? It's a detail I wanted to mention now. It's an important detail, but in this context, quite difficult to erase something. You might add something or change something. If you use a hammer and a nail or something, you could change something, but quite difficult to erase. So for the last century, the majority of the time in the last century, we were also ledgering, we were also making ledgers, but it generally looked like this, something like this. If you had nice handwriting, you end up in a museum, for example, but this is ledgering in the majority of the 20th century, on paper, pen and paper usually. And a nice detail in this is during the Dierenoten incident that we mentioned, that at some point the minister Donner in a television interview in response to a question from journalists said, right, no problem. If we can no longer trust digital certificates, we just go back to pen and paper. Right, Minister Donner, just as an example, the sheer volume of digital transactions, this is an example of Nasdaq, the stock exchange in the United States, just an example of the sheer volume of digital transactions taking place, 25 billion, not million, 25 billion messages through Nasdaq on an active day. That's a lot of messages to sign on pen and paper, right? That's a lot of messages in a financial services industry. This is a lot of containers, for example, in the harbor of Rotterdam. Over 7 million containers annually coming in and going out of the harbor of Rotterdam. That's a lot of transactions taking place, right? A lot of transactions, a lot of documents that need to be signed, etc. Transactions in a container context or a transport and logistics concept for context, for example. Over 7 million. This is another example of transactions, cadastre. The organization, the institution that monitors, for example, the housing, the buying and selling of real estate in the Netherlands, Kadaster, in English, apparently, Kadaster. I didn't know that, but that's interesting. Housing registry, a lot of transactions taking place there as well. In the harbor, for example, the container, the previous example, 20,000 containers per hour. Wow, that's a lot of transactions. The majority of these systems. So here comes the issue, here comes the challenge. The majority of these systems, the registration in harbor, the registration at cadastre, the registrations in financial services industry, ledgers in financial services industry, ledgers in retail, etc. The majority of these systems are what we now call centralized systems. They're kind of like depending on a central location to administer, to register all the transactions that took place or are taking place. So it's a highly centralized system, which is in need of a central, trusted, what we call trusted third party. So if you're a member of the financial services industry, for example, and you're one of the nodes in this image, you're one of the nodes, you need to trust your financial services institution because your financial transaction is going via the central institution. Do you still trust the financial services institutions? Pretty much okay, right? So there's this interesting story about the world's oldest still operational financial services institution, the world's oldest bank. Do you know which bank that is? It's in Italy. Is anybody here who can speak Italian? I always pronounce this wrong, right? So the abbreviation I can do, that's MPS, but it's Monte dei Paschi di Siena. Paschi, there you go. I'm sorry about that. I continue with the abbreviation, MPS. I can do that one. But it's a lovely bank. If you happen to be in Siena, and actually I was married about 12, 13 years by now ago in Siena, it's a lovely town, and there's a lovely headquarters of the MPS in Siena. And they founded this financial institution in 1472. 1470, that's 10 years, 15 years before Columbus discovered, it was already there of course, discovered America. That's an old bank, that's an old financial institution, right? And can you imagine, that's kind of like a mind game I always like to play, can you imagine that there is no financial services industry yet, or nothing similar to what we now call the financial services industry, or what we now call or refer to as a bank, there's nothing there, and you go to the wool merchant of the city of Siena, for example, you go to the wool merchant, and this wool merchant has been working for weeks to create this value, this wool. He's painted the wool, he's untangled the wool, etc. A very difficult job, brilliant job, a lot of hard work. And suddenly you're making a little bit of money in Siena at the marketplace. And here's this person coming up to you on behalf of an organization called MPS. Nobody heard of it, on behalf of MPS. So I've got this good idea. Why don't you give me all your money? You would be okay with that? Yeah? Because in that case, I have a question for you later this morning. But okay, so I would be amazed. I would be surprised. I would say, what do you mean, give me all your money? Can you elaborate a little bit on this? What do you mean? What are you going to do with my money? Am I going to get my money back? Can I trust you? So the majority of these centralized systems are largely dependent on a trusted third party in the middle of this centralized system. And this is in the financial services industry. But it's also in the healthcare. It's also in transport and logistics. I was just finishing a phone call with the association in the Netherlands for agriculture, for example. They have a lot of transactions as well. They have a highly centralized system currently for those transactions or for managing and administrating these transactions. Highly centralized. Now, what is a classic handicap or challenge? Not necessarily a problem, but a classic challenge in a centralized system. Your developers, you know this. You've got a single point of failure. Do you know where it is? It's in the middle. It's in the central system. Because you're centralizing, right? Of course, you're creating basically a central point of failure, a single point of failure in the architecture. That's critical, of course. That's a challenge. That's an issue, right? Not necessarily a problem. You could address it. You could create dual systems. You could solve it properly in the architecture or whatever. But still, by design, it's a challenge. There are some issues with this. Okay, imagine if you're in the financial services industry, for example, or in the healthcare, if you're in the financial services industry, and this is your model, and in order to do a transaction, you need to have a bank account, because it's a centralized system. You need to have a bank account. You need to have access to the financial services industry in your country, in your region, in order to do a financial transaction. Now, we call this initiative at a higher level, at the United Nations level, the next billion, for example, because there are at least a billion people in the world, on the planet, maybe not in the Netherlands, but on the planet, there are at least a billion people without access to this central financial services industry system. So while this has been serving us for a couple of hundred years, quite well, I mean some recent hiccups in trust apart, but this has been serving us quite well, this centralized model, it is maybe not as inclusive as we want it to be, or as Gavin Wood called it, indeed. It would be nice to design a system in mind with inclusiveness, or with inclusiveness in mind. So what would be an alternative to a centralized system? This is an easy question, right? So I used to be, just give a little bit of context, I'm a technology officer now, right? So I'm in these policy conversations, right? And then you have these questions and challenges and interactions. But I used to be an assembly language programmer, yeah? So this was like in 1987, when I was writing software, terminate and stay resident programs. Do you know them? You are old. Ah, that's good. So you do know Brian Ferry as well. That's good. So we were developing terminate and stay resident programs. Those were using interrupts, as we call them, from the processor in order to have some software running in the background of MS-DOS. MS-DOS familiar? Yeah. Okay, that's cool. So that's my background. I started out as a programmer, assembly language. From programming, I did some project management. From project management, I did some consulting. From consulting, I did some marketing. From marketing, I'm now doing a technology office, which is kind of like an ambassador. And every now and then, you run into conversations with industry associations, with government officials, with policymakers, where you really have to explain what the alternative is to a centralized system. So I'm sorry, of course, you already knew this. The alternative would be a decentralized system. Now, this is interesting. Can you think of a decentralized system currently in an industry or a process or a market? Bitcoins. Good audience for this session. Yeah. So decentralized system, that's interesting. There is no centralized third party in this model anymore. I don't need to, if this were the model for the financial services industry, I wouldn't have to go to a bank, to a financial institution, in order to have a transaction with some of you, for example. We can do the transaction ourselves. I don't need this centralized third party. I maybe, if we develop this in the right way, maybe I don't even need to trust you. I do, of course, but I don't. Maybe I don't even need to. If we architect this system in the right way, maybe trust could be implicit in the design. Maybe trust could be programmed into the software. Maybe we could develop an algorithm which basically proves mathematically or by design or by encryption and such technologies that indeed the trust is in the system, is in the code, if you will, rather than me looking you in the eyes and thinking, I can trust you, I cannot trust you, I can trust you. Rather than in the individual conversation about trust or individual proof of trust, let the system handle the trust conversation. And this is actually something, I mean, I wasn't there at the time. Otherwise, maybe things would have been different. Maybe you, if you were there, things would have been different. But at the time the internet was designed and developed, we forgot about this. We skipped this. There are two things, basically, maybe more, but there are two things, basically, that we forgot when we designed, when other people, I wasn't there, when other people designed the internet, there are two things that they forgot. Identity is the first one, but you're familiar with that story, I think. Huh? Identity on the internet is a challenge. How do you prove who you are on the internet? You're all familiar with the famous image of the cat, right, or the dog. On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, etc. So it's identity is something that we now are developing on top of the internet infrastructure in a very effective, successful way, perhaps, etc. But at the design time of the internet, identity was not a major thing. The second thing that we forgot about on the internet, when we designed the internet, basically, was to design a system of zero trust. Was not bolted in, was not designed, was not developed in. So we're now bringing it, if you will, as a layer on top of the internet infrastructure. If you think of the internet as a digital infrastructure, like in the ISO layer modeling, you've got the physical infrastructure, then suddenly you've got the network layers, etc. If you think of the internet as a layer, maybe we can think of trust and enable a model like this as a layer on top of the infrastructure of the internet. This is something that came to mind to a person or a group of individuals or an organization. Nobody really knows who this person is, right? Or unless maybe you're better informed than I am, could be. But do you know Ryuichi Sakamoto? That's not him. That's a musician. A musician who wrote the music, the score to Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, for example. But that's also an interesting thing. If we forgot about trust, if we forgot about the design in the internet, something happened with the music industry as well. Do you remember in the 90s, we were using Napster, for example? Of course, we were not. But some people, not us, were using Napster to download music or movies, etc. on the internet. You remember this? You read about it, right? You heard about it. So the thing is, the whole design of the internet, the whole design, if you will, of the internet, was about making copies. So you're not really having one version of Ryuichi Sakamoto's album on the internet. In fact, if you want to have a copy, you really get a copy. It's not a single instance of the album on the internet. You create many multiple digital copies. So I was old enough to remember Brian Ferry. Another anecdote, are you old enough to remember Project Xanadu? This has nothing to do with Olivia Newton-John, by the way. Do you remember Project Xanadu? Not many people do, huh? So at the design time, so this is an anecdote I'd like to tell, and if we were with a smaller audience, this would be a very engaging and interactive part of the conversation, because Project Xanadu was an original design for what we now call Hypertext Transfer Protocol, or HTML, or the World Wide Web. Project Xanadu was about leveraging the internet infrastructure to create exactly one copy of a document, one copy of a movie, one copy of a music file, one copy, one version. There's only one original document. And Project Xanadu said, okay, if you want to have access to the document, we're not going to send you a digital copy. No, we're going to send you a link to the original document. And then we're going to make sure that indeed the original document stays original, stays in its place, etc. And only thing we're sharing over the internet infrastructure are links or pointers. That was Project Xanadu's original thinking. It completely failed. Or at least that's my perspective, that's my idea, that's my interpretation of what has been going on. It has not really materialized. Might be a more nuanced perspective on this. But it has not really materialized, this Project Xanadu. But it's brilliant. If you look it up on the World Wide Web, of course, on Wikipedia, the single source of truth, right? If you look it up on Wikipedia, you'll find a brilliant reference to Project Xanadu. And it was the original thinking of having the internet as an infrastructure and the content on the internet as a single version, a single copy, rather than all kinds of digital copies being distributed over the internet, what we experience now. It has been helpful. Perhaps has been very supportive of a growing economy and the adoption of the internet, but there is maybe a design flaw in having the ease of digital copies flowing around on the internet. For example, could I copy, do you have euro bills in your wallet, for example? Cash? Does anybody still use cash? Fewer and fewer people do, huh? But it's one of the most inclusive forms of money, right? You can always lose it, you can share it, you can distribute it, etc. You can give it to people, cash. But if you have a 10 euro bill, for example, I could make a copy of it, but that would not create new value, would it? I mean, some countries think it does, but no, it doesn't work that way, right? There's a single bill, and that's the original 10 euro bill that represents the value, and any copy of it is a fake copy. It has not the same value as the original one. And this is a design flaw, if you will, if you try to think of the internet, or if you try to use the internet for content or data or processes that actually need a single copy rather than the ease of multiple copies, etc. Now, a distributed system like this is very easy on the internet. It's very common, of course. The whole World Wide Web is designed like this, for example. It's very distributed. It's great. But what if you want to make payments on the internet? And you create a digital copy of a 10 euro bill on the internet. That's slightly more challenging. And as the music industry experienced, the digital copying of music files and video, that's also creating interesting challenges and issues, right? So distributed model, interesting. Perhaps the alternative or a solution to some of the challenges in a centralized model, but it creates challenges. And one of the challenges is indeed, how do you create or how do you leverage infrastructure like the internet, technologies like the internet, for systems and processes that actually need to make sure that there is only and exactly only one version of the content, of the object, of the data, of the document, of the money, of the coin. And then you had this person, not Ryuichi Sakamoto, but somebody else, another person or organization, etc., writing a paper on what he called, or they called, or she called, Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. Now that is interesting. We have proposed a system for electronic transactions without relying on trust. I mean, you could spend whole days thinking about what that means, right? You make an electronic transaction without relying on trust. Any transaction that we think of currently needs some form of trust, an explicit trust, an implicit trust, a trust of third party. What do you mean without relying on trust? That's very difficult. It's very difficult to imagine what we mean without relying on trust. And before, this is very small print, don't even try to read it if you... But there's another person called Nick Szabo, who made wrote an article in 1997, so a couple of years, about 10 years before the Bitcoin paper. And Nick Szabo wrote a paper on indeed, how can you develop, how can you think, how should you think about a digital system not relying on trust, or not relying on explicit trust. The trust is implicit in the process in the system. But at the time of Nick Szabo's paper in 1997, he had no real ambition or design, or at least that's my view, no real ambition or idea or concept to really develop a crypto or a digital currency. He just made up the algorithm. He just made up the context of developing a smart contract, for example. We'll come back to that. He designed the idea, the context, the concept of developing a contract where you don't need a trusted third party to actually verify the contract, to verify that you are you and I am I, etc. No, you don't need to trust the third party. You don't need to bring trust as an explicit element. The contract itself is designed in such a way, is developed in such a way, using programming code, using mathematics, using encryption, that the contract itself maintains trust within the contract. That's a paper from 1997. So by now it's 2016. So that's almost, how many years ago? Okay, good. 20 years ago, just about, right? 20 years ago, somebody invented the idea, the concept of developing an algorithm where trust is built into the algorithm rather than the dependency on a third party. And 10 years later, Mr. and Mrs. Organization Nakamoto developed a solution on how to use that model, that algorithm, that design, that thinking for digital currency. And that became the Bitcoin, which we all know. But in fact, the algorithm, the idea was already 10 years or published 10 years before that. Now, what are the characteristics, if you will, for such a system? What are the characteristics for this system called the Bitcoin that was designed or developed or documented by this Nakamoto person, organization, etc.? There are four things, basically. Still, it's a ledger system. It is still a system of administration. And of course, it could be done in stone tablets, but that would be hugely inconvenient from a logistic point of view. So the ledgering, if you will, in this system is digital. There's a digital database, if you will, taking place of making notes of all the transactions. Something going in, something going out. It's noted in a ledger, in a digital ledger. It's not on paper, it's not on stone, it's a digital system. If you want to look at it as a database, that's fine. It looks like a database, it acts like a database, but it's not a database really. But okay, it looks like a database, fine. A ledger. Something going in, being noted in a digital way, something going out, noted in a digital way, etc. But a characteristic of this ledger is that it is indeed not centralized, but distributed. So if I have a ledger on stone tablets, it's easy to imagine there's probably only one copy of that stone tablet at one time in one location. It's central stored on paper. If you have this ledger from a grocery shop, for example, it was usually stored in a closet underneath the counter, for example. There was one copy of that ledger in that organization. If you go to the financial services institution, if you have a bank account, your bank account is maintained, or your bank is maintaining the ledger of your bank account in a centralized organization, a centralized stored way, etc. Now, interesting element in this conversation, interesting element in the thinking of the Bitcoin, of the blockchain, which is the underlying architecture thinking, is that it's rather distributed rather than centralized. So everybody has a copy. And exactly the same copy, and a validated exactly the same copy of the ledger. So that's an interesting model. You've got a ledger, digital, if you want a database, and everybody has exactly the verified, exactly the same copy of that ledger. If you participate in this organization, in this community, in this Bitcoin example, and then it's on the left, it's secure, meaning that indeed we can verify, we can make sure that if you make a transaction in this system, if you make a transaction in this Bitcoin environment, if you make a transaction in this distributed system, we make sure indeed that this transaction is authenticated in a way, that the transaction itself is securely encrypted and stored in the ledger, that in fact you cannot make changes after you've stored it into the ledger. So it's a highly encrypted, it's leveraging encryption to make the system, to make the ledger in fact immutable, as it's called. Non-repudiation, that's such database terms. Any transaction into the ledger stay a transaction in the ledger. You cannot mutate it. It's a very secure environment in that sense. And it's shared. In fact, it's a system, it's a decentralized system that grows in value the more people or the more organizations participate in the system. So most of the deployments or most of the developments leveraging Bitcoin or leveraging the blockchain architectures, they benefit from as many people participating in the community as possible. And being a distributed system, it also implies that there is also, usually for the majority of these systems, there is no real ownership of the system. Everybody participates into the community. Everybody participates in distributing, in storing, in maintaining the ledger. So it's a highly, what you could argue, a highly democratized system or process. Now, something else I wanted to highlight, it's this part. So usually the conversation starts with with Bitcoin. But if you look at what the Bitcoin is, it's actually currency, and it's a use case, if you will, of an architecture that is called the blockchain. So underneath the Bitcoin, but it was basically an afterthought. The original idea was, let's develop or create Bitcoin. And suddenly people thought, wow, the architecture underneath Bitcoin could actually be used for different purposes as well. And that architecture is called the blockchain, because that describes also the technology underneath the Bitcoin. So the architecture is called blockchain. Usually it started with simple ledgers, but currently we're more thinking of developing smart contracts. And we're going into leveraging the blockchain as a ledger for this huge environment, this huge development on Internet of Things, for example. We have got millions, billions, if you will, at some point, millions of Internet of Things, millions of things being connected to each other, and you still need to validate that the transactions coming out of a thing indeed originate from the real thing rather than a copy of the thing, rather than a hacker, etc. So the whole ledgering, if you will, of all the transactions coming out of things in the context of Internet of Things, that's also being blockchained, if you will. So a thing could order, for example, electricity, power, by itself, for itself, using a smart contract. What is a smart contract, by the way? So we developed an idea, perhaps, or we understand grasp the concept of a Bitcoin digital currency, perhaps. But if you have the underlying architecture, currency is basically payload. It's just the data of the architecture of the infrastructure. And if you change the payload to be something else, you can play around with the blockchain. And somebody thought of using the concept of the blockchain and the payload for coding. And in fact, smart contracts are basically, if you will, it's not exactly right, but you get the idea, it's basically a JavaScript. You could embed coding, you could embed rules, you can embed a structure, a document, a programming structure in the payload of a blockchain. And what happens then is if you take the blockchain 2.0 smart contracts development, you could create a container, a physical container in a transport and logistics context, for example, and add to that container a smart contract. And the smart contract could say, if this container is delivered into the harbor of Rotterdam, that triggers a certain event in my contract, meaning that I now need to pay out somebody because it has actually been delivered from Japan into Rotterdam. The contract could handle those transactions. It could be documented, programmed into that contract, based on, for example, events happening to the object where the contract is attached to. So blockchain 1.0, usually thought of as an infrastructure for payment, digital currency 2.0, usually thought of as smart contracts, intelligent contracts. Intelligent smart contracts are basically kind of like JavaScript, scripted documents as payloads in the blockchain. And the third version, the third edition of the blockchain development are going to be blockchain as an infrastructure underneath Internet of Things to create a ledger of all the transactions of the things in the Internet of Things. This is an example. KBC, one of the largest banks in Belgium, they are thinking of what blockchain could mean to the financial services industry. And they've developed a solution together with the Association of Small and Medium Enterprises in Belgium. And they are developing a trade solution, leveraging the blockchain as an infrastructure for trade agreements and trade payments and trade transactions, if you will, transactions. No longer depending on an independent trusted third party. So what is KBC actually creating here? Their biggest competitor? Or are they creating an alternative to KBC? Or do they see a new role for a financial institution such as KBC in the context of these blockchained transactions and processes? Everybody, majority of organizations, is still looking for their role in this context. Nobody is really sure yet. As with Billiton, for example, one of the world's largest mining companies, they have an issue with ownership of the mined products, for example. And a mined product, we talked about a single copy of an object, a single copy of a document, single version of content. Billiton ran into challenges and issues with having ownership issues of a mined core, an earth core. So you drill into the earth, you pull up a few meters of the earth, for example, and this is very valuable data because the core sample, the sample of the earth's composition underneath where you're drilling, it gives a clue as to the mining resources into that area, for example. So this is a very valuable object. And Billiton buys these core samples, sells these core samples. There's actually a marketplace for core samples. But how do you create a marketplace, a global marketplace, on these core samples? You could create a physical marketplace. You could build something like eBay on it. You could create a marketplace in the Netherlands, etc. Or, as Billiton is now experimenting, you could create a distributed, a democratized marketplace using the blockchain infrastructure, and you can have any party interested in core samples participate in that network, in that framework, and, for example, offer core samples or buy core samples. And the digital ledger, the blockchain as a digital ledger, maintains a full record, a non-repudiated, a full secure record of all the transactions on that core sample, for example. The more participants, yes. Yeah. So what I mentioned, so the question is indeed, does more participants in the blockchain, does that also add more overhead or more cost to the transaction in the blockchain? So my remark was, the more participants in the blockchain solution or in the process, the more valuable the process and the blockchain concept as a whole becomes. The majority of blockchain solutions, the majority of blockchain supporting infrastructures, they already come, even without a large number of participants, they already come with a high cost of transactions. This is also, so it's slightly increasing with the more participants, etc. But that's not a real impact. A blockchain transaction is already a relatively high cost transaction. That is also why there is some confusion in many conversations, where people think that Bitcoin is going to replace all currency. All currency is going to move to the blockchain. That's not the thinking of the majority of the financial services industry experts, because the cost per transaction, and actually the time needed per transaction to update the blockchain, the cost is too high and the time is too long. So if you have microfinance or micropayments, for example, of a couple of cents, the cost of a blockchain transaction would be higher based on the compute resources used in the cloud, for example, or based on the electricity used to compute the blockchain value. The cost of a blockchain transaction would be higher than your actual financial transaction. So the thinking is indeed, the cost of a transaction is already relatively high, the duration of making a transaction is relatively long, so it's not going to replace all the financial systems, but it's going to bring new solutions, it's going to offer a new potential to different processes in financial industry. It's not going to replace all of the currencies that we're currently thinking of.
What I don't understand, is there one blockchain the same as right. Bitcoin, or are there many blockchains? And if
good point.
Is not used for Bitcoin, how, what's the reward for yeah. Computing those numbers?
Yes, so you're referring to mining, but mining is optional in the context of blockchain, but it's heavily used, of course, in the Bitcoin context, but it's optional technically. So the question is indeed, okay, can there be multiple blockchains? Should it be only one blockchain? How does it work? Is every digital currency depending on the blockchain of the Bitcoin? What can we do? So, starting point, blockchain is a concept, is an algorithm, is a design idea, is a paper, if you will, is a concept. And subsequently, you have several organizations implementing blockchain algorithms in certain solutions. That's what you can do, of course. Blockchain is an idea, a concept, algorithm, design principle. Next step is you can develop something. Somebody already developed something and leverage that blockchain to develop a solution or a market called Bitcoin. That's fine. Meanwhile, it's of course free to choose if you want to develop your own blockchain. If you want to, you can create what is called a private blockchain for your own marketplace, or a private blockchain for your own industry, or even, if you want, a private blockchain for your own organization. You could. Doesn't always come recommended, but you could create private blockchains per industry, private blockchains per organization, because it's just an implementation of the algorithm, of the concept, of the idea. If you want to create a copy or a new version, let's say Bitcoin the Netherlands, Bitcoin 2.0, Bitcoin, or any coin. There's a Kanye coin. Do you know this? You know this? This Kanye West is suing, I believe, this Dutch person. But there's a Kanye coin. You can just create a coin if you want, leveraging the blockchain infrastructure. You can do that. It would be on you to subsequently create the marketplace for that coin, to create interest for that coin, to create value for that coin. But in the end, blockchain is just an algorithm. You can choose your implementation. If you want to use that implementation to create your own digital currency, you're free to do so. As did a couple of people, for example. So I'm skipping a few slides, because in the end, it's a layered model. It's a way of looking at it. I like to look at it in this way. You've got the internet. That's just telco. That's just infrastructure. Of course, it's not really that, but it's a telco. It's a digital infrastructure. Great, we have that. On top of the internet, you could use, as an example, but being here at Microsoft event, you could use the Microsoft Azure as an infrastructure, right? You've been to Azure sessions, I assume, or you already know what Azure is, so I'm going to skip that. But you could use the Azure infrastructure. And on top of Microsoft Azure, Microsoft offers something together with a partner called Blockchain as a Service. That's offering the blockchain as an algorithm, as a model, as a starting point for your own developments on top of Azure. So you've got the internet, digital infrastructure, meaning it's you have, in potential, a global customer base. You have global distribution, if you want to. That's the internet. You've got Azure on top of that, also globally present with many regions. You know the commercial and the marketing story behind it. We've got Microsoft Azure in every region, more than any competitor, etc. Great. So it's a global infrastructure that we offer. On top of that, you can develop any blockchain solution, any blockchain process that you can think of. So, for example, an organization, a company called Ethereum developed, not necessarily on top of Azure because it's independent of Azure, but they developed a system for smart contracts, and that can be deployed or run from the blockchain as a service infrastructure on top of Azure. So what Ethereum did, they created an environment where basically they used the blockchain, and as payload in that blockchain, they let you do some coding. They let you document, prescribe, describe what the contract is, what the contract looks like. If this is the document, if this is the physical object, if the physical object arrives in the harbor of Rotterdam, the payout to the original sender, X amount of money, etc., from this transaction account, etc., etc. So you could document, you could fully document a transaction. This is difficult, it's very challenging, and it also comes with an issue. So let me finish this first before I go into the next point. So yes, you can develop your own blockchains. Yes, you can develop your own solutions on top of the blockchain. You can create private blockchains. You can create community blockchains, market blockchains, etc. You can have an independent software vendor. You can have a brilliant idea, for example, smart contracts, and develop a product on top of the blockchain, etc. It's a layered model. Ultimately, in that smart contracts, there's something that I wanted to make sure we addressed. That's this. Being a developer, again, you already know this, but with the majority of people that we talk to on the blockchain and the impact of blockchain and industries, etc., we every now and then have to point out. So you have a smart contract. You document, you write, you code your contract, for example. You say, if this happens, then this needs to happen next. And if this is the context, then this needs to happen next. You need to verify the sender. You need to verify the payee, etc., etc. So you code, if you will. It's not really JavaScript, but you code kind of like in JavaScript your contract. Then you better make sure that you code everything exactly right in that contract, in that smart contract. Because as you know, a computer is going to execute exactly what you program it to do, right? So if you make a mistake in a smart contract, the computer is just going to execute that mistake. And this is some confusion that happened a while ago. There's an organization called, they call themselves the world's first distributed autonomous organization, DAO. Do you know this organization, DAO? So it's a distributed autonomous organization. If you are a distributed environment, if you create a distributed environment and there's no real ownership, you could call yourself at some point, if the scale is big enough, etc., if it has grown, has enough adoption, usage, etc., autonomous organization. So they call themselves distributed autonomous organization, and they created a marketplace for buying and selling stock into organizations, for example. They created a financial marketplace. Now, the interesting thing is this autonomous organization is, of course, hugely dependent on smart contracts, because there's no person validating who you are, if your transaction is valid, etc. Everything needed to be coded exactly right in this smart contract, in the code of the contract. And there was a small mistake. As it sometimes happens, we made progress, right? I remember from experience, we do make mistakes, and there was a small mistake in the code of the global first, world's first distributed autonomous organization. There was a small mistake in the coding. If you go to an ATM, right? An ATM is the machine that you go, the flopper top in Netherlands. If you go to the ATM and you need to get cash out, right? You're putting your bank card in it, and then the first thing the machine does is check the amount of money on your account. Then you type in, I want to take out 100 euros, for example. Then the machine checks, do you actually have 100 euros in your account? And if you do, then it pays out, right? That would be the logical order of things. Do you know recursive processes? We do, recursive processes. If you have no hobbies, you do some recursive programming on fractals, for example. It's brilliant stuff, great stuff. But recursive means a process can call itself. If you're standing in front of the ATM, it's quite unlikely that you keep calling yourself, but you're standing in front of the ATM, you put your card in, the machine checks the amount of money on your account, and if you have enough money, then it pays out, right? The problem in the contract, in this case, was the order of events. There was somebody in the DAO system trying to take out money, and the system contract said, okay, I can authenticate who you are. Yes, you have an account. That's great. Okay, you want to take out money. Okay, great. How much? Okay, $1,000. Okay, here's $1,000. And let me then check. Not the smart way. Not the right order of doing things. And especially not if you're a clever programmer and you develop a recursive program that calls the DAO system to pull out $1,000 or $100. And then calls it again to call out that 100 and builds a recursive system and only within the loop ultimately checks the saldo, the right amount of money in your account. So this is what happened at the DAO attack at the time. It was a recursive call to take out money of a certain account. It was a programming error. There's no problem in the blockchain. There's no problem in the Bitcoin. There was a programming error in the smart contract. That's still going to happen. So the blockchain, how are we doing time-wise? Nobody knows. Oh, we're over time already. So let me summarize again using this image. So the blockchain is just an infrastructure layer. It's very important. It's very clever. It's a very smart infrastructure layer. It's on top of Microsoft Azure, which is the cloud infrastructure. It leverages the internet as a communications layer, if you will. And on top of the blockchain, you develop your own solutions, such as smart contracts. And if you do use smart contracts or if you do develop smart contracts, make sure that you program the smart contracts in the right way. So it becomes a completely new job profile, if you want. Programming, developing smart contracts. Probably a mix between developer and a lawyer, probably. That would be make an interesting birthday conversation, I think. Yeah? But okay, probably somewhere in between there. So this is the way that I look at it. Now, I was supposed to tell you something about this as well. Let me use this. So if you use Azure as an infrastructure, you've seen slides like this before, I think. The blockchain as a service is just one of the parts, one of the elements, one of the moving engines, moving parts in the Azure infrastructure, in the Azure fabric. And if you do use Azure as your starting point for blockchain as a service, you get the benefit, the added benefit of, for example, combining your blockchain service, your blockchain solution with Cortana Intelligence Suite, with the business intelligence tools, etc. So basically, blockchain as a service becomes an element in this whole Azure model. Now, I wanted to show this slide that it's actually live, that you can actually start it, that there are multiple templates in the Azure environment already for you as a starting point. So indeed, if you do want to develop your own digital currency, by the way, the Dutch National Bank has its in its annual plan for this calendar year to develop its own DNB Bitcoin. Just as an experiment, not necessarily that you're going to pay with the DNB Bitcoin next year, but as an experiment to learn, to understand, etc. This is happening all over the world. People are experimenting with these currencies, and they're leveraging, for example, these starting points. So this is an interesting starting point. And if you're thinking, I need templates, you're familiar with the Azure templates, probably. There are multiple Azure templates already in for Bitcoin. And ultimately, if you're having a hobby like me, then you can use the dev test labs. Are you familiar with the dev test labs? There's a very long URL. I shortened it for you this morning. There's a URL now called akams/devtestbaas. I thought that was nice in Dutch, right? Okay. Dev test BaaS, blockchain as a service. BaaS means boss in Dutch, right? My last name. So aka MS dev test BaaS is a short URL. Then you'll end up in on a white paper that will explain how you can start a dev test environment which is already preloaded with blockchain tooling. So I did this just as a demonstration how inclusive the starting point of Mr. Wood, how inclusive the blockchain is. I did this actually on my mobile phone, just creating a new blockchain, if you will, a very private blockchain environment. It's very accessible, of course, very inclusive. And then this screen is familiar to most of you, I think. Yeah? This is the waiting screen. If you run something in Azure and it needs to start dev test in this case or delete something, you get that in between. So, summarize. So I started out this whole conversation, this session, that the audience turnout is much larger than we were expecting, because I had two handicaps. The first being a technology officer, which creates kind of like a gap between being a real developer and somebody who uses PowerPoint a lot for his job. So that was kind of like one handicap. The other handicap was that I was going to do a level 100 session on blockchain, a little bit of context, a little bit of background, and that wasn't to go down very well with developers at Dev Days. However, you turned out with a lot more people than I was expecting. This comes with a responsibility for you, which I already mentioned at the beginning. Some of you were slightly later, and that is that this whole blockchain thing is quite complex to grasp for policymakers, for decision makers at a political level, at business level, etc. So if you do have a good understanding of what blockchain is, if you do have a good understanding of what blockchain is going to cost, is going to disrupt in several industries, please publish articles, write blogs, send out Twitter messages, etc. Make sure that you communicate to your audiences, to your managers, to your customers, etc., that blockchain is going to happen, that stopping blockchain is not a realistic option at this time, and make sure that organizations and decision makers really understand what the blockchain is going to mean for their organization. So I hope I touched a little bit on the context. It's a very big context, blockchain. There's a lot of things going on in financial services at a political level. Kadaster in the Netherlands has already published white papers on how Kadaster is thinking about blockchain. Agriculture Association is using blockchain for a market, for developing a new marketplace, etc. It's happening all over the industry in most markets. So this was a brief introduction, a brief background. It was maybe a little bit messier than I expected, than I wanted it to be, but it looked like a presentation, I think. All right. Thank you very much.
Hey, ik heb nog een vraag voor je.
Ja,
je zegt dat de mining optioneel is in de blockchain.
Ja.
Hoe zou dat dan